Good afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Monroe Carman. I am president of the Press Club and editor-at-large at Bloomberg Business News. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience here, as well as those of you watching this program on C-SPAN or listening on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind our audience of coming speakers. On Thursday, December 7th, Olympic medal winner Paul Wiley, the ice skater, will be here to talk about the future of amateur and professional ice skating in the United States. On Thursday, December 14th, George David, Chief Executive Officer of United Technology, will talk about his national strategy for employee education in a time of permanent corporate commitment to restructuring. And on Friday, December 15th, John Sweeney, the new president of the AFL-CIO, will talk about his agenda for American workers. Transcripts and audio and videotapes of Press Club luncheons are available by calling 1-800-NPC-2334. I'm also pleased to announce the publication of a new book, The National Press Club's Best Contemporary Speakers. The book contains 13 of the best speeches made in 1994. And again, to order a copy, call 1-800-NPC-2334. If you have any questions for our guest speaker today, please write them on the cards provided at your table. Pass them up to me, and I will ask as many as time permits. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. From your right, Gretchen Parker of the Houston Chronicle, Aaron Epstein of Knight Ridder Newspapers, Keith Epstein of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Natalie Spingarn, third place winner of our contest, short story contest, 1995, of this year's short story contest. Thank you. Ralph D. Toledano, the second place winner of this year's short story contest sponsored by the National Press Club. Sandra McElwain, freelance journalist. Barbara McConaughey, Washington playwright and former Helen Hayes Award nominee. Moving down to my right, Mark Johnson, Media General News Service and chairman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. John Fogarty of the Kiplinger, California Letter, and member of the Speakers Committee who arranged today's luncheon. Thank you, John. Joyce Winslow, who is the winner of the 1995 National Press Club Short Story Contest. Ron Sarrow, news director of Washington News Network and former president of the Washington Press Club. Jonathan Gardner, Crane Communications, honorable mention, winner of the Short Story Contest this year. Katie Hobson, Bloomberg Business News, and Gil Klein, Media General News Service, chairman of the Short Story Contest and Media Past President of the National Press Club. Before introducing our speaker, I would like to present our annual Short Story Awards. It is often said that every reporter has the first chapter of what he or she is sure will be the great American novel tucked away in his bottom drawer. But to test that theory, the National Press Club Board of Governors holds an annual short story writing contest. In this, our third year, we drew more than 50 entries. The first round of judging was done by the faculty of George Mason University's Creative Writing Program, directed by Bill Miller, a former Washington correspondent for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Helping Bill select the five finalists were GMU faculty members Jody Brady and Mark Farrington. The five chosen stories were then sent to Faye Moskowitz, a professor of creative writing at the George Washington University and the author of 3 novels, who selected the 3 prize winners and 2 honorable mentions. First honorable mention goes to Jonathan Gardner of Crane Communications for his story, McCollum, An Introduction. Jonathan? The other honorable mention goes to Ferdy Groffé, Jr. for his story, Zola and Our Lady of the Snows. Since Ferdy lives in Washington State, he could not be here today. Third prize and a check for $200 goes to Natalie Spingarn for her story, Janie's Fräulein. Natalie? Second prize and a check for $300 goes to Ralph Di Toledano for his story, Small Ways of War. Ralph? And first prize, and a check for $500, goes to Joyce Winslow for her story, The Priest's Housekeeper. Faye Moskowitz praised Winslow's work for its haunting imagery and symbolism, its complexity of theme and characterization, and above all, for its graceful prose. Joyce Winslow has won 9 national short story contests in the last 3 years. She is included in the Best American Short Story Collection and the Pushcart Prizes. She is a freelance journalist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Washington Post. Her story, The Priest's Housekeeper, which will be available if you'd like to read it at the front desk after the luncheon. The Priest's Housekeeper is about the current wave of anti-Semitism in Austria. Congratulations to Joyce Winslow.
Thank you, Bud, and judges. It's an honor to receive this award from the National Press Club because the National Press Club is my favorite institution. I've long enjoyed the opportunity to hear wonderful speakers like Edward Albee from this podium, and now to be here among you, my fellow journalists and our distinguished guests, it's thrilling. It's appropriate that the National Press Club recognize short story because the first short story writers were journalists. Bret Hart, Mark Twain, Edgar Allan Poe, Melville, even Crane. It's also appropriate that the National Press Club take up the gauntlet where, unfortunately, the National Endowment of the Arts must leave off. Since we spoke 2 years ago, the National Endowment for the Arts has been stripped of its budget for writers and artists, and I'm not the only writer who has, during her writing career, taken an oath of fiscal celibacy in order to have the time to write fiction. So I am very grateful to the National Press Club for their support. Thank you.
Our speaker today, it can be said, is America's greatest living playwright, which I'm sure he'll agree is preferable to being America's greatest dead playwright. 3 of Edward Albee's plays have been awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Drama. A Delicate Balance in 1967, Seascape in 1975, and 3 Tall Women in 1994. The latter is now being performed at the Kennedy Center. Mr. Albee's most famous work, sad to say, did not win a Pulitzer. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf won a Tony, the Drama Critics Circle Award, and was voted the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 1962. However, the work was so controversial that the Pulitzer trustees refused to grant the award because some members found the play to be offensive. As often happens in these cases, the controversy over the play's dark and brutal view of human relationships and its shocking comic tone only served to heighten interest in both the play and the playwright. Today, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is an American theater classic, and its author is established as a vital and influential force in modern drama. Edward Albee was born right here in Washington, D.C. in 1928, and he was born to the theater. Since 2 weeks after his birth, he was adopted by Reed Albee of the Keith Albee Theater family. Our guest attended and left a number of private schools before landing at and graduating from Choate. He attended Trinity College in Connecticut, but did not stay to get a degree. Ms. Albee has had a tumultuous relationship with his stepmother. He has identified her as the protagonist of Three Tall Women. Quote, he says, "I didn't end up any more fond of the woman after I finished writing the play than when I started." Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure he'll discuss that and other subjects. Please join me in welcoming Edward Albee.
I think before anybody calls me a greatest American living playwright, somebody ought to check it out with Arthur Miller. Because this may surprise you to know that, but I don't think Arthur would agree. Now, one thing that I would like to recommend before I start shooting my mouth off is the way you give the cash prizes in the short story awards. I think that the third place winner should get the most money. Because if you're going to be third place winner, you should get the greatest compensation, it seems to me. And go up, and the second place winner gets the middle, and the first place winner you probably shouldn't give anything to, because the honor is so great. Now, we are supposed to do two things in the next, 45 minutes? I'm going to talk some, and then I'm going to have a conversation with you, not at you, with you, answering your questions. I don't want to talk too terribly long, two reasons. First of all, I know what I'm going to say, and it's interesting and it's pertinent, but I keep having to say it over and over and over again because nobody pays any attention to me. And also, it may not have a great deal to do with some of your concerns, so let me divest myself of a few opinions and a little autobiography. And then I would love to spend most of the time with your questions. I should tell you probably a little bit, the temptation to use this is extraordinary. I should probably tell you a little bit more about who I am and how I got that way. A little bit about me and writing. I wish I had become a writer when I was 6 years old, because that is a year before the age of reason. But it wasn't until 8 that I decided that I was a writer. I hadn't written anything at 8, but I decided that I was a writer, and so it logically followed thereafter that I wrote something. I had learned to read a couple of years earlier. I had enjoyed that experience, and I guess I thought I needed something that I would really like reading, so I started writing. having no common sense at all at the age of 8, I began writing poetry, the most complex and naked of all the literary forms. And I wrote poetry from the age of 8 until the age of 28, when I finally desisted. It wasn't that I wasn't getting better. I was. I think I can say without too much argument that most of the poems I wrote when I was 28 were more accomplished than most of the poems I wrote when I was 8. Certainly, I was imitating far more sophisticated masters as I went on. I remember when I was 12, I went through my E.E. Cummings phase. I didn't use any capital letters. My poems were very bizarre typographically, and I was enormously sentimental. And it was a very good imitation of E.E. Cummings. And I went on and imitated a great number of other people. And I think that had I gone on writing poetry for another 20 years after I stopped, I would have emerged finally as an enormously skilled, enormously minor poet. But the problem with all of this was that I never felt like a poet. I felt like somebody who was writing poetry. There's an important distinction between the two. I was getting published, aside from the school literary magazines, where I almost always made myself editor and filled them with my work. I had poems published in two, albeit tiny, but still, national poetry magazines, one poem when I was 15, another when I was 17. Both of these poetry magazines existed very briefly in West Texas. And I like to think that it is merely coincidence that the issue in both cases in which they published a poem of mine was the last issue they published. I like to think it was coincidence. I had a little help along the way suggesting to me that perhaps poetry and I were not the ideal bedmates I had thought we were. Thornton Wilder once said to me after reading my poems, "Edward, have you ever thought about writing plays?" I'm not certain that he saw in my poetry the incipient playwright. I think it was simply that he was trying to save poetry from me. I wrote two novels in my teens. If you know any teenagers who are planning to write the worst novel ever written by an American teenager, tell them it's done. The novels are hopeless. They reside in the theater collection of the New York Public Library with a huge pile of my juvenilia and a tiny little stack of my theoretically mature work. But they are there with the admonition that though they might be studied by scholars and pedants interested in gaining perhaps a more comprehensive misunderstanding of my work, they may not be quoted from publicly. The first novel, which I wrote when I was 14, was some 2,200 pages. And the second, when I was 16 and my energies were either depleted or elsewhere, only 800 pages. I attempted the short story along the way, and I discovered that the short story and I had severe disagreements about its nature, and that the short story was probably right. And so I stopped doing that. And since I had decided when I was very young that I was a creative writer, which merely meant that I didn't have to worry about being able to think coherently in a straight line, the essay form was beyond me as well. So here I was, living in New York City, having been thrown out of college in the middle of my sophomore year, which amuses me since now I teach at the University of Houston, where I'm referred to by some grand title as what? Distinguished Professor of Drama. And I dare say I'm the only distinguished professor of anything in Texas that doesn't have a college degree, but no matter. I was lapsed poet, failed novelist, forgotten about essays and short stories, but I was a writer. What to do, what to do? I mean, here I was, lurching toward 30, and a writer, taking nothing but a series of odd jobs, because I didn't want to take any job that could possibly become a career. So I wrote a play. And it was called The Zoo Story. And in writing that play, I discovered my nature, my identity, what I was, and who I was, that I was a playwright. I had written one play before The Zoo Story, a three-act sex farce I composed when I was 12. But my mother threw it away, my first critic. And given the state of theater criticism in the United States, one of the more intelligent ones I've come across. But since that play no longer exists, I can pretend that The Zoo Story is my first play. I wrote it in 1959. It had its world premiere in 1959, the year I wrote it, but not in New York City, where you would think, and not in English, what you would think, but in West Berlin and in German, because there was no off-Broadway then to speak of. And it was done on a double bill with a play by Samuel Beckett, perhaps last tape. And then it moved to New York, where it ran for 3.5 years. I quit my job delivering telegrams for Western Union and proceeded to write plays, which is something I have continued to do up until the present and plan to continue to do much into the future. I like being a playwright, which is fortunate, since it's one of the few things that I can do with any competence. I like the immediacy of the theater. I like the fact that the theater always exists in the present tense, and that at its best, it is an argument against the status quo. A serious play always holds a mirror up to people and says, look, this is who you are. This is how you behave. You don't like it. Why don't you change? This is the function of all of the serious arts in the United States, and is one of the serious dilemmas we have in this extraordinary country. The lack of healthy relationship between those who take the trouble to create arts in our society and those who, for whom the trouble is taken, for whom the arts are created. It was a very interesting time in our history when I discovered that I was a playwright and began to practice my nature and my craft. It was concurrent with the election to the presidency of John Kennedy. It was an amazing time in our history. It was a whole generation of us who suddenly sprang into being as creative artists. The ground was fertile. The response was going to be there. The Off-Broadway theater was born, and a sudden new generation of American playwrights sprang into being. Jack Gelber, Arthur Copert, Leroy Jones, on and on. Whole John Guare, a whole new generation of playwrights, and many, many off-Broadway experimental theaters sprang into being. It was an enormously important time in our culture, in all of our culture, for many reasons. The paperback book market exploded on the American scene, and people were able to get for very, very little money not only the classics from Europe, but also the avant-garde work from America and Europe. People were beginning to participate in the arts, just generally. You could go to concerts of contemporary serious music in New York City, and finally, there would be more people sitting in the audience than there were performing on stage. Museums and art galleries were beginning to show the work of tough young artists, and people were paying attention. And our government, the federal government, decided, I think in some kind of extraordinary wisdom, that while we're supposed to educate people to a 12th grade level in this country, nobody is truly educated unless they receive an aesthetic education as well. So the National Endowment for the Arts began. An unconscious, perhaps, comprehension that an aesthetically informed electorate is better able to govern itself than one that is not. What shocks me so much about the present attempts in the Congress to destroy the arts education in the United States is that we will raise, if we are not careful, a generation of enormously educated barbarians. It was indeed an exciting time to be involved in the arts in the United States. Universities discovered that they had a captive audience of young people in the theater and in the other arts who had not yet made up their minds as to the limitations of their participation in the arts. It's interesting that in the 1950s, early 1960s rather, something shocking happened. On university and college campuses around the United States, of the three most performed playwrights, three of them were living playwrights, something that would have been unheard of merely 10 years before. It was indeed an exciting time. We were participating as a society in the arts, paying attention to them and learning from them, being willing to learn from the tough truths that the arts were there to tell us in a way that was extraordinary. But then, there's always a but then, is there not? In 1968, with the election to the presidency of Richard Nixon, we began a retreat from this high participation in the arts. Perhaps it was nothing more than Mr. Nixon's own vaunted anti-intellectualism. Perhaps it was the usual two steps forward, one step back that accompany adventures in a democratic society. Or perhaps it was something far more dangerous, and I think it was. The beginning of an awareness on the part of our people that we were learning too much from the arts. We were being informed about consciousness, about our possibilities, and our lack of limitations in a way that was forcing us to behave in ways that perhaps we didn't feel we could live up to. We began a continuing to the present day and accelerating, I feel, retreat from the great days of the artistic participation in this country. I travel a lot, and over the years I've spent a lot of time in dictatorial societies, since that seems to be the majority of the planet. I spent a lot of time in the then Soviet Union, meeting with dissident writers who became good friends of mine, and meeting also with the cultural commissars of that extraordinary land, who determined which novelist would be published in an edition of 2 million and which one would be sent to a prison camp for writing a book, who decided which composers would lose their jobs at the teaching music if their music was too avant-garde, who decided which painters could be shown at the Tretyakov Gallery in Moscow, and which abstract painters, if they dared have an exhibit of their abstract paintings on the banks of the Moscow River, could have the army bulldoze paintings into the river. And I met a very interesting young man one night in 1963 in Moscow, a young man named Andrei Amalrik. Some of you may have heard of him. He died after he was thrown out of the Soviet Union. He died in northern Spain one midnight, mysteriously. He was on his way to Madrid to monitor the Soviet non-compliance with the Helsinki Accords. He wrote a book called Will the Soviet Union Survive Until 1984? He wasn't terribly far off, but he was put in prison 3 years, having written that book. One night in Moscow, he and I were talking, and he postulated a theory, which was that the people who ran the culture in his country were determined to effect what he referred to as a semantic collapse between our two cultures, create a situation when there could no longer be any communication, intellectual, aesthetic communication between our cultures. Well, I had heard this before, of course. I'd read my George Orwell. But it was interesting being in Moscow, hearing it in the lion's mouth, so to speak. I went back to London, I think, a few weeks after that conversation with Amalrik, and I began to wonder whether this kind of semantic collapse that he talked about need take place only between two such different societies as our own and the Soviet, or could it take place right here at home? Could the time not come, ultimately, when there would be no longer any relationship, those truths which the creative artists wished to tell the people, and those truths which they were willing to pay any attention to? And it occurred to me that, yes, indeed, this semantic collapse could take place, and I think is taking place in our society. Mind you, I would rather be a writer in the United States than any other country I have visited. The occasional hostility, the occasional indifference, the occasional intentional misunderstanding the creative artists face in a democracy such as the United States is nothing, is child's play, compared to the literal life and death matter of daring speak out as a journalist, as a creative artist, in many, many countries. We know what happened in Africa last week with the killing of a playwright. Go back in our history, examine what happened in Nazi Germany, examine what happened in the bad days of the Soviet Union, examining what is happening in mainland China now and in other countries, where creative artists are silenced and quite often killed. So, being a writer in the United States is child's play. It's basically nothing. But it makes one wonder, if push ever came to shove in the United States, if a real Nixon were to come along one day, how many people in this country would go to the barricades? Have we become so passive a society that not many of us would? There is nobody in the United States right now tell us, no, you may not read that book. No, you may not look at that newspaper. No, you may not harbor that thought. No, you may not be taught by that person. No, you may not participate in the arts as you will. There is nobody to tell us this, with the possible exception of commerce in our society, which in some ways strikes me as being the equivalent of the thought control in the dictatorial societies. But aside from commerce in this country, there is nobody to deny us access to all of these tough truths that the arts can tell us, except for one person, ourselves. We deny ourselves so much. We deny ourselves access to those arts which may trouble and disturb us. We are the censors of ourselves. It is enormously damaging, enormously dangerous what we do. But why should anybody concern themselves with the state of the arts in the United States today? We've had a rather rough 25 years, have we not? We've had the presidency disgraced. We have had two generations of young people turn off from the political process on the assumption that it is fixed, it doesn't work, it makes no difference. We have had our economy put in a shambles. We used to be the wealthiest country in the world. Now we are the largest debtor nation in the world as the result of the tripling of the national debt during the Reagan administration. The question has been raised indeed. Are we that kind of civilization, Max Lerner was kind enough to call us, that kind of civilization that may be indeed on its way downhill without ever having reached its zenith? And now we see forces in the United States which are determined to destroy the cultural life of the country, determined to dismantle the aesthetic education of the people in our society. What is everybody so frightened about? Be very fearful. Be very fearful of any society that fears the arts. Be very fearful of any government which wishes to control the dissemination of the arts freely and to all. These are frightened people, and they are enormously dangerous. The only reason that the arts really matter is that the arts are one of the few things that distinguish us from all the other animals. We invented the arts to define ourselves to ourselves, to define consciousness to ourselves. And we live still in a society where there is nobody to deny us access to the tough truths the arts can tell us. Nobody yet, except ourselves. The most important thing to remember, there are two important things to remember about a democracy, of course, the first of which everybody pays a great deal of attention to. The first thing about a democracy is that in a democracy, you can have anything you want. The second truth about a democracy, which most people don't want to pay any attention to, is this. In a democracy, you end up with exactly what you deserve. Thank you for your time.
We have a lot of questions, and I'm going to try to condense some of them and see if we can cover a lot of topics. Several people asked, really, the meaning of Three Tall Women. They liked it, but they're not sure they understood. All right? Is it about, as one critic said, the triumph of growing old, or is it about the utter foolishness of it all, or of a life lived in such ignorance of mortality? Or is it, in the end, a celebration of life at every stage?
Yes. any play that can be defined or described at all well in one or two sentences should be one or two sentences long. Three Tall Women concerns itself, I suppose, with the fact that throughout our lives we make choices. And if we're at all lucky, we will end up at the end of our lives not filled with regret over what we have not done. That is an oversimplification of what the play is about. But it concerns itself, as a number of my plays do, as A Delicate Balance does, with the fact that so often we become so rigid and have allowed our circumstance to so deny us the possibility of changing that nothing can be done to us. A Delicate Balance, for example, is about that as well. All drama is about the choices that we make to other people and to ourselves. As a playwright, I provide very, very few answers to anything. I have many more questions than I do answers. If I were to limit the number of plays I had written to those plays for which I had answers, posing questions for which I had answers, I would not have written 24 plays so far. I might possibly have written one or two. It's not my responsibility to provide answers, but merely to hold that mirror up and say, is this who you are becoming? Be careful. Watch out. It's the best I can do to answer that question.
Another questioner asked, I saw your play at the Kennedy, and I must say I was shocked. Did a double take at the construction. Was that done as a means to jolt the audience for effect, or as a necessary way to get your point across?
Of course, from the way that question is phrased, I have absolutely no idea what the questioner is talking about. I suspect the question has to do with the fact that Act One of the play gives the impression of being totally naturalistic, and that Act Two gives the impression of being not realistic. But within the parameters of the definition of reality in each act, they are both highly naturalistic plays. Obviously, the structure of the play is there because I thought it would work most effectively. I hope for the questioner's sake that the questioner was not so taken out of participating in the play by the nature of the structural alterations between Act One and Act Two that the questioner didn't participate in Act Two.
You have identified your stepmother as the protagonist.
Adoptive mother.
Adoptive. as the protagonist in the Three.
I don't remember what protagonist means. Is she the protagonist or the antagonist? I don't
know. The leading figure. Several people will ask you if you would be so kind as to discuss your relationship with her and with your father. And as a corollary, they ask, have you ever wanted to learn about your birth parents? And if so, what came of it, and to what extent is a delicate balance about adoption?
A delicate balance is not about adoption at all. When I was adopted, they made it absolutely, or as impossible as they could, for one to find out anything about one's natural parents. Checked the natural parents, I think, both to protect them and the adoptive parents. And until I figured out who I was, I used to care a lot about who my natural parents were, since I didn't get along with my adoptive parents at all. But once I figured out who I was, I decided to let well enough alone. I didn't get along with my adoptive parents. A shame for both of us, I suppose. I don't think I was quite what they thought they were getting. They were well-intentioned people. They're both gone now. Both well-intentioned people, but I found even very, very young that their values and mine were in total opposition. They were political and social reactionaries. They were naturally bigoted, as wealthy people were in those days. Their tolerances, their bigotries, their concerns were not mine, even from a very, very young age. And so from a very young age, I found myself quite outside of that family, which probably is fortunate, since I didn't turn out to be like them. And I found myself observing myself in my childhood and in my adolescence, watching myself in this particular environment. I discovered finally that is what writers do. We observe ourselves participating in our own lives at the same time that we are participating in them. This is called writer's healthy schizophrenia. We all do it. My adoptive father was a very quiet and very passive man. I don't think he and I, in my entire residence in that environment, had more than two conversations of any seriousness. I was happy to leave when I was 18. I did not see him ever again because he died 12 years later, and I did not see my adoptive mother for some 25 or 30 years after I left home. I left home. In a situation that was enormously, enormously bitter on both sides. I started seeing her again when I was told that she had a heart attack and was all alone. And I felt, what? As one of the ladies says in Act Two of the play, 20 plus years is a long enough sulk on both sides. And so I started seeing her again. We never became friends, I don't think. She harbored and continued to harbor her bitterness and hidden rage over my daring to leave home and become myself. But we passed social time with each other. I tried to make a point. I'm sorry it's not published in the program at the Kennedy Center. I wrote sort of a shortish essay on how I felt as a result of having written Three Tall Women. I did not write it as a revenge play. I was not after a particular kind of revenge or even an exorcism. What I was after in that play was really being as objective as I possibly could and creating a fictional character who enormously resembled in every aspect my adoptive mother. And so when I was writing the play, I had the feeling that I was creating a fictional character who happened to be exactly like somebody who I had known. People who knew her, especially in the last 10 and rather unpleasant years of her life, tell me that in the course of the play, I was too nice. I was too generous, and perhaps I was. Perhaps that was the objectivity, not writing as the theoretically wounded son, but just as somebody who was observing. Did I leave anything out?
No, that's fine.
Oh, good.
I think that's very well done. Thank you. So let's move on to Virginia Woolf. How did you happen to write that play? Did you know of such a marriage?
Whether or not I knew of such people is immaterial, since we all must understand the fundamental rule that life imitates art. After I wrote Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, I started going around to universities, and I invented the entire situation. invented the characters. Every place I would go to lecture, somebody would take me aside and would say, "You've been here before, haven't you? You know Dr. So-and-so and his wife, don't you?" So where did Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf come from? The collective unconscious? I don't know. Well, let me tell you what I think will be of help, if there are any pedants in the room. It will be of help to you if you wish to know this. I suspect that in some ways Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was written as an answer to Eugene O'Neill's play The Iceman Cometh. In that play by Eugene O'Neill, as you will remember, O'Neill postulates that you cannot live without false illusions, pipe dreams, as he has the characters call them in that play, that false illusions are necessary to survive. That play impressed me very, very much when I saw it when I was, 16, I think, very young. I think Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, in part at least, is a refutation of the theory of that play, because Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf suggests to do away with false illusions, strip the deck, to get down to absolute truth, if you will, or at least fact, and to try to build a relationship without false illusions, or if you are going to maintain your false illusions, do the necessary and very important thing of knowing that they're false.
What can be done to revive serious theater in this country, besides relying on such groups as the Signature Theater? And what accounts for theater's demise anyway?
Theater has not died. The arts in America have not died. Theater has not died. We probably have more good young playwrights in the United States now than we have ever had, in my memory. We have more interesting young painters and sculptors and novelists and poets than we've ever had in this country. It's just that it's getting tougher and tougher and tougher for them to reach a mass audience. This was part of the commercial censorship that we have in our society. The people who fill the Broadway theaters with these lugubrious musicals these days to make the theater safe for people who do not wish to have a useful experience in the theater, if they were told that the audience wanted to see Samuel Beckett and Chekhov and Pirandello, Broadway theaters would be filled with Beckett, Chekhov, and Pirandello. It all comes down to what they believe will sell. The greatest novels and books of poetry published in the United States are not the best sellers. A number of bookstores in the United States act as a kind of censor by not carrying the finest books that are published, but only the mass sellers that they know will move and sell thousands and thousands and thousands of copies. This is a kind of commercial censorship of the arts. When my play, Three Tall Women, opened in New York at a very, very small theater, 195 seats, my producer, wonderful lady named Liz McCann, wanted to, and got great reviews. The play got great reviews. She didn't. It did. She got good reviews, too. She wanted to move it to Broadway because it got unanimously favorable reviews. Not one single Broadway management wanted the play. Not a one. Schubert Organization, the Niederlanders, none of them wanted to have anything to do with it. So she moved it off Broadway to a 550-seat theater where it ran for a year and a half, very happily. Serious drama in the United States, for the most part, is relegated to the smaller theaters, where in some ways it's more comfortable, but people are being misinformed right and left as to the nature of drama in the United States. If they only go to Broadway, they will see very, very, very little that has anything to do with drama as a serious art in the United States. You go to your mass drugstore bookstores in this country, you're not going to know very, very much about what is indeed going on in poetry and in serious fiction in the United States. There is this particular kind of commercial censorship that we have based solely upon what will sell, what is the least common denominator. It is a crippling form of censorship, but is tolerated only by people who wish to tolerate it. If we had a society filled with people who wanted to participate as a natural part of their lives, as natural as breathing in all of the serious arts, if we were able to grow a couple of generations, people who cared about the serious arts, if our educational structure and our educational system permitted this, and if our government was not determined to destroy the aesthetic education of the people in this country, we might conceivably raise a generation of people who would not tolerate the mediocrity of what is being pushed and sold in the arts in this country. We can have it. I said about democracy before. We can have anything we want. But look around you. We're getting what we deserve.
You've spoken out in favor of the National Endowment for the Arts, but the questioner asked, if you really don't want government determining what is art, then how can you take money from the government? And shouldn't we eliminate the National Endowment for the Arts?
The National Endowment for the Arts does not take money from the government. It takes money from the taxpayers. This is not a pile of money that the government has hidden away somewhere and has decided to give out with some largesse. This is not Mexico, where the presidents and the senators each leave office with $500 million. No. This is money. This is people's money. It is not money from the government. I've served on panels in the National Endowment and the New York State Council on the Arts. And never once in all of the times, though this began to change not long ago, never once did I find that there was any attempt on the part of anybody who was sitting with us while we made our deliberations as to who was most aesthetically worthy of receiving support. Never once was any pressure put upon us to say, no, you really shouldn't want to help that person because that person is too far to the left, for example, or that person is gay, or that person is dangerous. No. All of these determinations that we made as aesthetically informed people guiding the National Endowment for the Arts, never any censorship put on us. I'm told that that did begin to change, ultimately, that the recommendations of a number of panels in the arts were ignored. Political pressure did become in. Once a creature, if you will, like the National Endowment for the Arts becomes the possession of legislators, and they can censor what is being done in the arts, then the entire thing should be abandoned. But that was not the reason it was set up. It was examined, it was set up to afford a little freedom from penury from some of the very best creative artists we had in this country. It was not meant to be a politically safe or a politically dangerous thing, for that matter. It was not the government handing out largesse to whom it approved of or was not afraid of. It was there an honorable experiment to provide sustenance to the very best creative artists we had in this country in the hope maybe we could start raising the level of public awareness and participation of the arts. But of course, we all know that that is terribly dangerous in some societies and sometimes.
Thank you, sir. Now, before we get to our last question, let us give you first a certificate of appreciation for being with us. We're very grateful.
Thank you.
Secondly, a famous National Press Club mug to keep you awake while you're writing those precious lines.
Thank you.
And finally, the last, what will your next play be about, and have you started work on it?
Until 2 days ago, I was very happily writing my new play. I'm about, 40% into it. Oh, I know it has four characters. I know it has two acts. I know that it is called, quote, The Play About the Baby, end quote. A very good title, I think, so that people can say to each other, oh, have you seen The Play About the Baby? And they will both be giving the title and describing what goes on in the course of the play. I'm very happy working on that one. But 2 days ago, all of a sudden, intruding into my mind, came a totally new idea for a totally different play. Now, I'm trying to tamp that one down and say, wait, I've got to finish this one first. But I quite often have two or three plays sort of floating around in the holding pattern of my mind while I'm writing one, but this is really extraordinary, that there are two plays, both of which are saying, write me, now. I hope I will finish the play about the baby, and then I will get on to this new one, which I do not have a title. So that's what I'm doing, plus all the other stuff that I do. I teach, I direct, I do various other things. But fortunately, I've always had two or three plays in my head ready to write down. I think there's one player that I still keep in my head that I got the idea for 12 years ago, and I haven't done anything with it. I think I'm trying to keep that play in my mind as the play that I will write when the day comes, if it does, that I discover that I have no ideas for plays. Then I will have that one. But then after I write that one down, there will come the time when I will have to decide, since I have no ideas for new plays, shall I stop writing or keep right on going? And considering the general level of theater in this country, I think if I have no ideas and keep writing plays, I'll be a much more successful playwright.
Thank you, Mr. Albee, and thank you all for being with us. Good afternoon.
Hey, 2 o'clock.
Well, didn't you get any of us? I mean, in the reception, you got two of us. I'm sorry,
Morning is best before I find something.
How are you?
I just went right.